Hi, welcome to the Juice with Juno. This is Juno's regular monthly podcast where I, Juno Man, talk about my favorite juice blend. Today we're going to talk about spinach and ginger.
I love it, you dumb fool.
You're going to call me a dumb bitch for saying that.
Welcome to the Rainbow Room,
our podcast about writing, representation,
and gay stuff.
This is season 4, episode 32, Baby Reindeer.
Hello, everyone. My name is Andrew Steyer, and today I'm here with my special guest, Juno Man.
Hi. We're going to have so much fun sharing this microphone over the next 20, 30 minutes. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
We're so happy to have you. And today we are going to be discussing Baby Reindeer, which I'm really excited about. But first, let's get to know our guest, Juno. So Juno is a comedian who I got to know while I lived here in Seattle. She's doing amazing work. And I'll let you kind of fill us in on, and actually, I'm curious as well, because I've seen snippets here and there. But yeah, what have you been up to lately? I know you run The Flock now, or help run it. And tell us everything.
Okay, one, I've never heard of anyone calling it The Flock, so I really appreciate that. That Flock is a monthly queer comedy showcase that happens in Capitol Hill. It was actually started, do you know Bobby Higley?
Yeah.
So Bobby actually started the show, I believe, as like a one-off show so that she could like fill calendar slots that were available with a venue that she was working with. And then soon after I started doing comedy in Seattle, she invited me and Zanae Aquino to take over as co-producers, and that was 2 or 3 years ago. And so at the moment, I'm the only producer for the show, but it actually was started by Bobby, and then Zanae really helped build it up as a pretty successful show, at least for the first year. Other things to note, what do people typically say about themselves? I'm bad about like proactively talking about myself.
I guess you can let us know. Do you have any exciting projects in the works? Any exciting festivals you're looking forward to? Any shows you have coming up that you're really excited about? Or just tell us your comedy journey in general.
Okay, so festivals coming up. I don't have any other festivals coming up this year, but I'm still waiting to hear back from a couple. I am going to be pitching at Fun and Flirty tomorrow night, which is a comedy dating show that happens at Comedy Bar in Seattle, though I'm guessing that by the time this podcast comes out, the show will be over. I'm doing Flock, a queer comedy showcase in Seattle on July 3rd at Comedy Bar. Is the episode going to be out by then? What? July 3rd?
Maybe.
And then sometime in August, I'm doing another Flock comedy showcase. I'm a stand-up comedian. I've been working in Seattle for a couple of years. I started doing comedy really in Seattle probably at the end of 2021. And it's been a lot of fun. Like, I've gotten to work with a lot of really cool people. I've especially really enjoyed getting to know more about like the queer and the women's comedy scene in Seattle, which is really vibrant, I think, relative to a lot of other cities.
Yeah, I've always really liked doing comedy in Seattle because it's one of the few places where you can actually find a lot, like even the straight male comedians know, like, oh, there's certain words you shouldn't and can't say. And especially in Seattle, like our audiences here kind of hold the comedians to task on like, don't see this problematic thing. Like, we're not going to laugh at problematic jokes, etc. And there's, as you said, really strong scenes in the queer scenes, the female scenes. It's really awesome here.
Okay, wait, can I ask what have you heard about like the Seattle comedy scene in LA, if anything?
Oh, nothing yet. I haven't. We haven't heard. I haven't heard much of the murmurs about the whole thing. Are you referring to what happened with Comedy Bar?
No. I'm referring more to like I've met with some comedians from like, you know, that don't regularly work in Seattle, so they're just here visiting, doing some shows. And sometimes some of them will make reference to, I think, part of what we just mentioned, which is like Seattle has a reputation for being very inclusive and very progressive. I think largely to the benefit of a lot of the people that work here, but sometimes to the deficit in that like there's some material that is really hard to work out when you're in Seattle versus like when you're touring in other cities or doing comedy in other cities. And so that's why I was curious about whether or not you'd heard anyone talk about what doing comedy in Seattle was like since you've moved to LA.
Yeah, I haven't heard anything yet, but are you referring to kind of like the, because like Seattle's known for being kind of like white liberal, right? And so there might be jokes that like, even if a person of color is saying a joke that's funny to people of color, a white liberal might be like, I'm not going to laugh at this because I don't know if I feel comfortable. Is that kind of what you're getting with that?
That's exactly what I'm getting to. But okay, what else do you want to know about me?
Well, you were I think notably you're openly trans. I think that's important to know. As part of that too, you've been featured in this. Weren't you recently featured like Seattle Gay Comedian or Queer Comedian?
Yeah. So Seattle Gay News does, I think as of a couple of years ago, they started doing like an annual best of list. This last year, 2023, I was named their best comedian, which was really, really cool. I will say, like, I remember, I think the first year they released like this list, the person that won was, were you active in the Seattle comedy scene when Stephanie Nam was doing comedy?
That name doesn't sound familiar.
So Stephanie Nam was doing comedy in Seattle for a lot of years. And then there was this one year where she was just like super active, producing a ton of shows. And that just happened to be the year that I started doing comedy in Seattle, like really started pursuing it. And she did so much for, I think, the queer and the women and the Asian and the POC comedy scene specifically. She produced a show called Men Aren't Funny. She produced a show called Model Minority, which was an Asian-focused comedy show, and I managed to get booked on a couple of those showcases. And she actually, so she won the Seattle Gay News Award the first year that it came out. And I think in large part because of the work that she was doing, I was able to like get up and develop skills. And so that's kind of the fun fact that I like to mention when I talk about like the Seattle Gay News Award.
How wonderful. That's really amazing and really inspiring and a good thing to note that we can like create opportunities for other people who are like similar to ourselves in that way. That's awesome. And props to you because you're kind of carrying that torch now in a lot of ways with Flock or The Flock, as I called it.
That's like, okay, one, that's like if I went to a town and I was like asking people where the Walmart was.
Oh, my God.
It's not the wall or the Costco or the Target. And two, I am doing nowhere near as much as Stephanie was doing. But it's really flattering to be able to like, I don't know, make good on some of the opportunities that she created in the scene.
Yeah, that's amazing. And we can always strive to do more too. I mean, I'm not doing as much as I could be and I want to produce more shows. So I'm inspired by your example and now in through the grapevine inspired by Stephanie's example.
Okay, perfect. My goal in this podcast when I agreed to do it was to get you to call me inspiring. And I managed to do that in the first like 6 minutes. So
shut up. Okay.
Happy Pride Month, everyone. It's Pride. Happy Pride Month. Go call a trans person inspiring.
Okay, you are... That is not where I went with. I feel baited. Happy Pride.
Pride.
Okay. So let's get into talking about Baby Reindeer, which came out this year, and let's talk about the I guess context of when it came out. First, I think we can note it portrays bisexual characters, it portrays trans characters, and it also deals with heavy issues like assault and dealing with stalkers. So just kind of the context of when this came out. I mean, I feel like some of these subjects, I feel like some of these subjects aren't covered as much, you know, in other shows. So I think it was kind of unique in its own right in a lot of ways. But what are your thoughts of kind of what was already out at the time and how this kind of compares to what was already in the zeitgeist or in the world?
Wait, so are we getting into like the show stuff yet? Or are we still in the non-spoiler section of the podcast?
You can light spoilers are fine. This is more just like, yeah, what this show is like compared to what's already been out and kind of how the context plays into how this show might have been received.
Okay, so that's a really, really good question. You said something just a moment ago that I think I might disagree with a little bit, which is that a lot of shows that come out don't touch on a lot of the themes that this show has touched on, right? That this show is exploring a lot of themes that aren't usually present in a lot of, I'm going to say, like mainstream television content. And I think that is not necessarily true, with the caveat that, you know, I'm an openly trans woman, and I think a lot of the content that I'm drawn to has characters that remind me of my experience. And oftentimes when trans experiences are portrayed in television or in movies, it's through the lens of trauma. And so a lot of the content that I consume, I think as a function of the bias that I have towards that content, tends to like incorporate some elements of trauma.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And this might be something we dive into more after the break, but one thing I think is interesting about this is it kind of, I feel like I haven't seen a lot of examples where a man is a victim of trauma, like this kind of trauma, and especially when a woman is the perpetrator of this trauma, right? And I feel like it can open up discussion of how bad that is in a way that, especially for some men who might be misogynistic, right? If they're not willing to like see through their misogyny of what kind of issue this is, to see kind of a perfectly valid example of where those roles are reversed, it's like, because I think a lot of trauma we see, right, is maybe like perpetrated by men in media, right? So to kind of have this flip, and there's so much nuance in even like using that reductive labels of who's traumatizing, who's being traumatized, etc. But still, that's something I found really fascinating about this show.
I mean, I will say, like, okay, so many thoughts right now. Well, one is that, like, I think you're absolutely right. Like, oftentimes, especially in movies and miniseries and television shows, and I would even go so far as to say, like, radio and literature and podcasts, like, just any kind of, like, entertainment content, we very rarely see masculine or male victims of assault and like their ability to work through that in a vulnerable way. And I feel like that's a lot of what Baby Reindeer is, right? It's this guy who, through this catalyst of events, ends up being forced to work through a lot of the trauma that was inflicted on him when he was younger. But also the, you know, I'd reframe the characterization of like the person inflicting trauma on him being a woman, because I don't think, and I don't want to get like too much into spoilers just yet, but I don't think that like his stalker is the one that's inflicting the most trauma on him, right? I think that a lot of what we're seeing throughout the series is how trauma that was inflicted on him by an older man when he was younger comes to roost in his interactions with the stalker.
Incredibly well said. Yeah, I agree 100%. And one last thing to talk about before we go to break. How did you hear about this show and how do you think it's been received? And I can start. I think my sister was the first one who told me about it. And she's like, hey, it's dark, be careful, but it's really good. Someone recommended it to me. So heard about it word of mouth pretty shortly after it came out. I feel like this is pretty like, you know, it hasn't even been out that long. We've both seen it, right? And then on top of that, someone...
I feel like in Netflix years, it's been out for like 30 years, right? Because it came out like a month and a half ago.
And that's 30 years in Netflix years.
Yeah, like if you don't watch something on Netflix within the first like 2 weeks, you're basically not going to watch it. It gets like deprioritized in the algorithm.
Yeah, that makes sense. So it's 30 years old in Netflix years. And then also being a comedian, it's one of those things where it's like, oh, you like sometimes when you're I have this with middle edition shorts, too, because I do improv. Like when you are in a hobby and something comes out that was related to that hobby, sometimes people will like, oh, have you seen this show that I know about that centers around your hobby? So I had another person I was talking to like mention it because I do comedy. So, yeah. How about you?
So I'm like pretty deeply on trans Instagram. Right. And there's very notably a trans character played by a trans actress in the show. And that doesn't happen very often, especially a show that goes number one on Netflix. Like that's maybe never happened as far as I can remember. Like, has there ever been a number one show on Netflix with a...
Whoa.
Like, has there ever been a number one show on Netflix with a trans character played by a trans actress that was part of like the main cast, right? So like she blew up on social media, like especially in trans social media. And so that's how I heard about the show.
That is so fascinating. I didn't even know that you were deep into trans Instagram or that was a thing. I love that.
I feel like if you're trans and on Instagram and watch any trans content, like it's just a snowball effect where you start watching a lot of trans content. And so you're just like algorithmically pushed into trans Instagram.
That's so interesting. So your explore page is just like trans.
It's a lot of trans stuff and a lot of cat stuff and a lot of comedy stuff.
Cute. I love that. Well, yeah, on that note, I think we are ready to watch a show. Are we ready?
All right, let's do it.
Let's watch the show. And we're back.
Happy Pride.
Happy Pride. Oh, man, it is super freaking good. But let me hear your thoughts.
Okay, wait, can I first point out that you are wearing a different top than you were during the intro. And so for like people watching at home, they're going to be like, did they record this on two separate days? We did not. Andrew just took his sweater off.
It's called a reveal, bitch.
You should hire a script supervisor. Is that what that person does?
For continuity.
Yeah, the person who's like, bitch, you didn't eat the bread that way in the last take. We got to do this again. Okay, so now we're talking about Baby Reindeer. It was a fun watch. It was hard to stop watching. Like, I got through the first episode and I was hooked. I was like, this is fascinating. I want to see where this goes. And the fact that, like, for me, there was very notably that trans actress that was in it. I think her name was, okay, I'm going to look at the cheat sheet. Nava Mao. Just made the show way more intriguing for me. And like, I really wanted to see where things went with her character specifically. But also, it's just like a pretty addictive show.
Yeah, it's hard to watch and it's hard to stop watching. It's like a train wreck. It's like, oh. But yeah, I agree. Nava Mao is great. Terry Teresa, she's like a great character. And it is also cool because she gets a very, I'd say a very flattering representation in the show too. You know, it's not like she's the butt of a bunch of jokes or like this really problematic person. And she's not like without her own flaws, but in general, I think it's a pretty, flattering representation.
So I like, oh my God, I could talk about this probably for hours because on the one hand, I agree. I appreciate that, like, unlike a lot of trans characters that have been written into shows before her, she was treated, I think, with a lot of dignity and respect throughout the show, her character was. And the way they wrote her character was in a really dignified way. Like, she wasn't constantly made the butt of jokes, which, like, even 20 years ago would not have been the case. So on that front, love that she was in it, love that, like, they treated her character with respect. What I didn't love, and I do kind of have strong opinions about this, is that she's a side character whose, I think, role in the show, at least based on my watching, seems to be to offer some kind of like redemptive foil for the main character, because he treats her pretty shittily throughout the show. Like, he does some pretty awful things that I think for most people would be like not just red flags, but absolute, this person was cruel to me. I'm never going to talk to them again. Like, why would I ever talk to this person again? And it's hard to watch her as a character constantly go back to a guy who is just so undeserving of her.
What were some of like the biggest things that he did where you're like, oh my God, this should be like, end it now, get away ASAP?
Okay, well, for one, like he kept bringing on the stalker, right? He kept like going back to the stalker for a variety of emotional and addictive reasons. So like, even though he was in an ostensibly healthy and stable relationship with this trans woman who, let's be very clear, was way above his pay grade, right? Like way above his pay grade. Because what do you remember what she did for work in the show?
Therapist.
She's a therapist. She was a fucking therapist. Do you know what that means? She not only went to undergrad, she went to grad school, got a degree, and she's American. So she had to move to another country and get certified in another country and was working as a professional therapist. And how did they meet?
An app, right?
An app where he lied about what his name was, about how open he was about dating trans people, and about what he did for work. He was a shitty comedian and a bartender dating a therapist. That relationship doesn't make sense.
Too true to real life, though. Like, shitty men ending up with women way above their grade. No,
absolutely. Absolutely. But I also, like, and again, this is my perspective, I also feel like on some level, it's a pretty accurate depiction of, I think, how a lot of straight trans women get into relationships with men, which is like, because trans women are oftentimes, I think, relegated or dismissed or marginalized within the female community, they settle for guys that are like significantly below their pay grade. And I don't mean to like imply some kind of social hierarchy here, but like objectively, she is better than him. Like if she was cisgender, would she be dating him? I don't think so.
You know, that's really interesting. I didn't even like think about what that must have been like watching as a trans woman who's possibly dated. Have you dated men?
Regrettably, yes.
But yeah, seeing, you know, I'm so in his point of view on the dating app, and when he's like lying about those details, but you may have had a very different reaction to that, like immediately thought of what it must be like for the people on the other side.
Well, like it's I don't know, like it's fascinating because my assumption, my read on the show was that he was lying about a lot of those things because of some surface level shame he had about being seen with a trans person, which I think really comes to fruition in the second or third episode when they're on a date, and they're on like their third or fourth date, I think, at this point. And he's made no moves. They've had no like physical intimacy. And she's just like, they're on a subway train and she's like, kiss me. And instead of kissing her, do you remember what he does? He steps off the train, lets the doors close between them, and doesn't say anything. Like, that for me is next level cruel.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, funnily enough for me, because it's interesting, I want to kind of pivot to, because just talking about like who we relate to on the show and stuff like that, what you said about how it's not really fair to just paint Martha as the perpetrator, right? In many ways, she's a victim, right? She has mental illness and she has a problem. She has a stalking problem. And this guy is really kind of encouraging it in a lot of subtle ways. And, you know, obviously there's ways he does and doesn't, right? And he does give clear signals of no, and she continues, right? There's all that, which is also really valid to talk about and like look at too. But yes, in that regard, as someone who has been led on before by men, it was, for me, that was really triggering to watch, of like, oh, like watching him think one thing but say another was really, and the way her heart melted at the words, it's hard to watch.
Same. I feel like I've had dating dynamics where I'm talking to someone that has led me on, right? They've said things that indicate that they are really into me, or that they're really comfortable with me, or that they'd really like to like pursue something more than friendship with me. And it's really hurtful when, like, you know, that's kind of withdrawn. Though I will say, I think I saw this more from Terry's point of view, because I've been that woman before, right? Where I've dated someone where in my head I was like, oh, it's really cool that this person, you know, isn't eating into the stigma of dating a trans person. Like, they're just treating me like a woman. And then like the moment there's the possibility of like public perception, like they withdraw so dramatically that it's very clear. And it's a super hurtful thing.
Yeah. Wow. And that's actually one thing I wanted to ask you, is how much of that seemed true to the true experience and stuff like that. So it sounds like a lot of it rang really true.
Okay. First off, can I just say, hi, we're two comedians. This is going to be a super funny podcast episode. How much of it did it ring true? How much of it rang true to me? Is that the question that you're asking?
Yeah. A lot of what we talk about on this podcast, right, is the authenticity of the representation, because that's really important, especially and notably because this, while the protagonist of this is a bisexual man, it was written by the man who went through this, right? I don't know that there was necessarily a trans person in the writer's room, right? And so do you think that the way this was written kind of had accurate representation of the trans experience? Obviously, trans people aren't a monolith. You can only speak to your own experience, but with all those caveats in mind.
You know, I do think that in a lot of ways, the way this show treated the experience of Terry, the trans character, really does ring true to at least a lot of my experiences as a trans woman, because we oftentimes are marginalized and fetishized and pushed out to the boundaries and treated very poorly, even in like rote, very basic romantic dynamics, like just going out to dinner or going out to drinks. All of that said, you know, while I do think that the representation of a trans person in the show is better done than in a lot of other shows, I still take such issue with the fact that like a lot of the role that I think she plays in the show is to make us more sympathetic to a character that treats her so chronically poorly.
That's really interesting. Like, you can see the intent of the writing and you're like, it stands at odds with how you are actually feeling. Like, this doesn't make me more sympathetic. This actually makes me like him less.
And yes, and maybe that's because of my experience with men treating me poorly because, you know, I'm trans. I will say, I do think that Terry is maybe the only character that is, I think, at the end of the show in a moral net positive, right? Do you know what I mean? Like, every other character kind of like, they have things that make them sympathetic. They have things that make them kind of villainous. And it's really unclear how we feel or should feel about them by the end of the show. But with Terry, you're just like, this poor girl, like, she's just looking to be with this guy who you know, again, she's way better than, but she's just looking to like spend some time with this guy that she likes. And he keeps doing things that fuck that up.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. And I also, you know, I think to give the writer some credit, I think if you're making something autobiographical, it could be very tempting and easy to paint yourself in much rosier light than was actually true to the event. And so I don't know how much of this exactly is true, which that's some tea we'll get to later, like how much of the story is true and the fallout of that. But in many ways, he paints himself negatively. I mean, a lot of people come away from the show being like, he was low-key the villain, right? And so in many ways, he may have been a reliable narrator, even to the point of showcasing some pretty awful flaws of his.
You know, I will say, I think that's something that the show does really well, is it's pretty unrestrained in how it depicts how bad the main character is. Like how, and not like intentionally bad, but like how he made some really severe mistakes intentionally, like not with the goal of making things worse for him or for other people, but just as a matter of not being able to control his impulses, or as a function of responding to a lot of trauma that he hadn't processed yet.
Yeah. And as someone who, you know, I'm I'd like to think I'm nowhere near as bad as Martha, right? But I am someone who is assertive in the way I approach people, right? And I have been led on. And so it is, there's some lessons for me that I took from this in watching, kind of in thinking of what Martha's gone through, right? And just like seeing what this villain slash victim slash protagonist, whatever you want to call him, goes through. One thing I thought was really fascinating is just because someone goes back to their abuser does not mean they weren't abused, right? And just because someone's coming back to you after leading you on doesn't mean they're not still leading you on, or like, or there might be some other thing that they're going through or processing that's like influencing them to come back to you, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you should continue to pursue them. It's a very weird thing, but it was also really like, oh no, like kind of thing to see and to know moving through the world, right?
Yeah, I mean, I do think kind of to the point that you just made, right? I think it's a depiction in a realistic manner of how some people that are abused will go back to their abuser, and that doesn't necessarily mean that they weren't abused. That's how the show ends, right? Like the last episode, he goes back to the person that is like objectively a villainous character, right? The purest evil in the show. He goes back to him, and I initially thought that he was going to confront him or have like a big blow up conversation, and we were going to get this like very satisfying moral resolution to his character arc and his like wrestling with all this trauma. And instead, he goes back, and this guy that had abused him for a really long time says, you know, if you'd like, I can probably get you a job as a writer. Is that something you'd be interested in? And instead of saying fuck off, he goes, yeah, let's talk about that. And then he walks away, and that's how the show ends.
Yeah, it's a really hard ending to watch. It's really does not leave you feeling good. And just kind of going back to that abuse point too, because this is probably something good for us in society to know too, like when we're watching out for people, and like because victims already face so much scrutiny and not being believed in their own story, right? And so I can see how that kind of thing could be used to discredit someone, right? And so it's important to know, like, hey, just because they went back to their abuser is not necessarily evidence that they weren't being abused, right? Like that this person was still an abuser. We see, and I don't know how much true to life this is, because I haven't talked to many victims of abuse, but we do see it fictionally represented in Euphoria, that first season where Jacob Elordi's character is in that like physically abusive relationship with that girl who then gets a restraining order against him and then proceeds to like have secret hangouts with him. It's a very interesting dynamic.
I don't know if I have anything to add to that.
That's fine. It looked like you maybe wanted to say something. This is the curse of passing a microphone back and forth, but hopefully audience, it's giving you good audio quality. What I did want to discuss was kind of what I alluded to earlier, was the tea of like how much of this is real, because aside from the queer representation, this is also just really fascinating from a writing perspective of woman, her last name is Harvey, people basically audience members sleuths that this was who Martha was written about. They identified her, And they've been giving her hate mail, etc. And she now has, she came out and did an interview, and apparently she's suing for defamation for this. And it raises a lot of interesting questions of, you know, what if you're writing something that's, you know, notably, they say in the beginning of this show, these events are true, right? What responsibility do you have to get clearance for the people involved in your own life if you're telling an autobiography before you talk about them? And
okay, for one, can I say that I hate that like people took it upon themselves to go sleuthing and to try to figure out who this person was, because like for as entertaining as social media is, I really don't love that it's given a lot of people the ability to kind of like violate a lot of privacy, right? Like you can stalk almost anyone on social media through like TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn even. And so like I wish that the show had done more to kind of like throw the scent off this woman's track, because like regardless of what she did, it sucks. Like I can't help but feel a little sympathetic to her that like people have just found her and are like unsolicitedly sending her hate mail. But I have also heard that she's like suing, I think, Netflix.
Yeah, I don't know all the details of the suit, but that is what's happening. And yeah, there's a bit of poking the bear with that too, because it's like if presumably at the end of all this, she had gotten to herself to a state where she was able to ignore him and distance herself from him and not stalk him. And now...
Yeah, no, exactly, right? Like if she had been able to move on from this, and this like now this door is just kind of foisted upon her and like rushed open, that sucks.
Yeah, it's rough. And so it'll be interesting, you know, people are surmising that this is actually going to impact what Netflix does in the future and what shows get made in general in the future, of like there's just going to be like a lot more scrutiny over, can we portray this, do we have permissions, etc., etc.
Okay, wait, not quite on this topic, but you know that she did an interview on Piers Morgan, right?
Yeah.
Did you watch that?
I watched bits of it. I saw the part where she's like just straight up denying, like, no, I never did that, none of those are true, like that's all false.
She was doing it in a manner that felt consistent with like the way her character was portrayed, like on the show.
Yeah, exactly. It's, I mean, and her character on the show was a lawyer and actually did know good tactics for kind of working the legal system. And it'll be interesting to see how that all plays out. There was one moment I really wanted to ask you about, going back to the trans representation. When Martha is kind of berating Teresa, and you know, at first Teresa's like, oh, I'm a therapist, I know that people are mentally ill, and it kind of seems like she's gonna go into this with the kind of a thicker skin of like, oh, this isn't going to affect me, like obviously this person's words mean nothing. But then Martha actually confronts her and starts saying all these things, and the character is actually viscerally affected.
Not just saying things, she's saying transphobic things.
Well, at first it was just like random things, right? But then she said, you look like a man, which was like the big one. I thought they really leaned into that comment and kind of her reaction to that. And I was wondering, did that seem... what was your reaction to the way that character handled that? And did that seem kind of like an authentic portrayal?
Okay, so I guess I have two thoughts, right? The first thought is... I feel like even if she was a professionally trained therapist, she should not have confronted that person in the bar. She shouldn't have confronted Martha in the bar, right? She should have just been like, let's leave, right? But that doesn't make for good Netflix content. And the second thing is the transphobic comment that Martha threw at her, the you look like a man, genuinely almost triggering for me, right? Like misgendering a trans person is really, I think, one of the most harmful things that you can say to a trans person. Genuinely, anytime someone misgenders me, it's the worst part of my day, and I think about it for the entire day, even if it happens accidentally, right? If someone does it maliciously and then they assault you, because she also assaulted her, right? That's like, that's deeply, deeply, deeply harmful. And so like, yeah, when I watched that scene, it reminded me of, obviously to a lesser extent, because I have not been physically assaulted by someone who is transphobic or trying to like throw transphobic slurs at me. But like it just brought me back to a lot of the feelings I've had about getting misgendered.
Wow. I had no idea. I thought maybe they were trying to dramatize it for the sake of like, oh, look, we have trans representation. But you're like, no, that's actually extreme. Yeah,
Well, okay, so I've talked to a lot of you know, my trans friends, and I've done a lot of research into like misgendering to try to figure out like how I can navigate moments of misgendering with a little more grace and patience and less distress. And it sucks. There's not a lot of research out there. There's not a lot of content out there. I did talk to a good friend of mine. His name is Sean, and he works in trans rights in Montana. And I think we were having a discussion, or he was reading something that I wrote, and I was trying to get his take on it. And he responded back, I think what you're saying is fine. If anything, I think you could get a little more reactive with it. I consider misgendering an act of violence. And I get where he's coming from.
No, totally. I mean, it's having someone misgender you maliciously, it's like basically, if not worse than the equivalent of like someone shouting the F slur at a gay person, right? Maliciously. It's like it's words meant to really harm you and cutting at the core of something and meant to discredit your identity.
I think discrediting your identity is a really good phrase to describe like the I think effect that misgendering, intentional or not, can have on a trans person. Genuinely, when I get misgendered, like it's just the worst.
Well, on that note, and you know, I should have warned y'all, this isn't gonna be a heavier podcast. This is obviously a heavy show.
On a happier note, right?
Well, we're not just gonna end the podcast. We'll do like final words and stuff. We got to go crying now.
For watching. What's the name of this podcast again?
Rainbow Room.
Thanks for watching Rainbow Room. hope you have a good night.
It's like the rainbow is just covered up by clouds. Just like
what if the new like intro theme for this is like LeVar Burton doing Reading Rainbow, and then he just breaks down crying at the end of like Reading Rainbow.
Yeah, we're gonna change all our music to like be in the tune of funeral dirges for this one.
Do you have the budget to get LeVar Burton? Because I feel like he could be a strong selling point for this.
I'll work on it. let's do final notes and final thoughts. My final thoughts on this show, hard to watch, a little triggering, raises a lot of interesting conversations. And it's interesting to see how the show's point of view maybe works with or contrasts with my own point of view in these characters. And phenomenal acting from a lot of these people. The woman who plays Martha Scott, what was her name? Cheat sheet. Jessica Gunning. Wow. I mean, I think she really acts her heart out. She really kills that. I believe her every step of the way. Yeah. So I thought it was a really good show, and I'm actually really happy to hear that a lot of the I hear your notes about kind of like your misgivings about the role and kind of the narrative and how she fed into the narrative of Teresa. But also I'm happy to hear of like how much of the representation actually seemed to be pretty authentic.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say I think I agree with a lot of your points. It was incredibly well made, very, very addictive, like very bingey, triggering as fuck. Such a triggering show for people of all different experiences, but really well acted. And we didn't talk about the fact that this was an Edinburgh Fringe Fest show. Like that's how it got the prominence, right? Didn't it break out of Edinburgh? And then like he got the Netflix deal?
Yeah, actually, I think it's really good you bring that up, especially as, you know, myself and maybe some of my listeners are thinking, how can we bring more queer stories to light and get more queer stories to the mainstream? And so I think it is, you know, the Edinburgh Fringe Festival right now is, I mean, maybe it has been for a long time, but it's huge. And it's just coming to light for me how many comedians are putting up one-man shows, one-woman shows, et cetera, at the Fringe Festival, and how, like, that's a very serious avenue through which people are getting discovered and getting their names out and networking.
Also, can we just talk for a moment, just a moment, about how it actually depicted what feels like, to me, what might be a real experience at Edinburgh, which is, like, someone showing up at a venue that they weren't expecting to be as crappy as it was, performing for people that don't want to see them, and just trying to, like, bark for people to come see their show. Like, desperately trying to get, like, one person in.
Yeah, that was the triggering part for me. But yeah, being a comedian and going and performing in a room where no one wants to see a show is awful. It's such an awful experience.
I once performed for a country club where everyone having dinner did not know that there was going to be comedy. And it was an old white person country club, too.
Please welcome your Asian trans woman comedian here to perform for you who do not want to be here.
It's me, Juno.
Gotta love comedy. All right. Well, on that note, I think we will have to say goodbye. Juno, thank you so much for joining me. We'd love to have you back on the podcast another time. And I would love to just keep seeing what you do with comedy and being on this journey with you is amazing.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you, everyone. Goodbye.
That's all for this week. If you like the podcast, the best way you can support us is by recommending us to others. You can also subscribe to us and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube by searching Rainbow Room Podcast. You can follow us on Instagram and TikTok at Rainbow Room Podcast and Twitter at Rainbow_Room_. Thanks for listening. See you next week.